paper is the Reflexive Autoscholastic Dissipation Special System Theory, which addresses the possibility of an emergent metasystem that includes the normal system and the three special systems in a single dynamic model of the metasystem.
Let's see. Yep. That's the best you get. Okay, my talk is on reflexive sociology, and basically, I'm not an academic. I'm from industry, but I, you know, started out in sociology before I went into industry, and in my research, I've more or less drifted into philosophy and drifted into systems theory, and done most of my work in systems theory, but then I discovered some things in systems theory, and I thought I'd bring them back to the sociology, the community, and see if anyone was interested. You know, since it's a short time, right, basically I jumped straight into the meat of it without much introduction. But the idea is that there's a standard systems theory, and I use the work of George Clear as the kind of basis of my my work on systems theory. And basically, what I did was I tried to extend systems theory to develop what I call metasystems theory, which is the inverse of systems theory. And it's an interesting thing that in our culture we have a blind spot about metasystems. And so I've tried to develop this metasystems theory. And then the the interesting thing is that I discovered once I had a clear view of what a metasystem was, that it turned out that there were three special systems that were like part way between the system and the metasystem. So there's some articulation there that would normally be hidden if you don't differentiate the system from the metasystem. So in this talk, I'm going to try to describe that. And when I talk about systems, I think of them kind of in this way, that, you know, we have an ontic hierarchy that there's various versions of, but basically, you know, things like particles and atoms and cells and organisms are all in this. Each one of these is an emergent hierarchy, and has different characteristics for each one. And it's basically the role of science to discover what these are. And the way that science does that is it tries extreme reductionism. And anything that it can't reduce eventually becomes recognized as one of these levels in the ontic hierarchy, which is about physis, you know, the kind of what's out there in the material world. But there's also a hierarchy on the ontological side, on the logos side, which I define as this, and this is more or less a hypothesis, but it's composed of, say, pattern and form and systems, and then these things I call metasystems, and then domains and worlds and so forth. And the curious thing about this, I call these schemas. And the curious thing about these schemas is that right here between the system and the metasystem is this special, are these special systems which are have some odd properties. The way I think about this is that a system I define as a gestalt, which is a social gestalt. So a system is a whole greater than the sum of its parts. Okay, so a system is something which the things in the ontological hierarchy are projected upon the physical world, right? So you can see systems in anything, right? It's a social projection, and so when you constitute a system by projecting it, you create a whole greater than the sum of the parts. You find the emergent properties there. I mean, the whole point of isolating a system is to figure out what these unique emergent properties are. But a metasystem is just the opposite of a system. A metasystem is a whole less than the sum of its parts. And the a good example of that is the sponge, right? A sponge is a hole full of holes, okay? So the idea is that systems fit into metasystems, into the niches of metasystems. And so when you have a system fitting into the niche, there's, you know, it's like a hand in the glove. You know, they fit directly in. So you try to put a program written for a PC on a Macintosh, nothing happens, right? You can't even read the disk, right? So the operating system determines what can function in that environment. And so, you know, so examples of metasystems, see, we don't have any word for the class of this schema, but examples are things like environments, ecologies, situations, contexts. We have a lot of media. We have a lot of different words for specific manifestations of metasystems, but we have no word for the general class, which is odd because we have words for the general class of all the other schemas, right? So you kind of have to go out of your way to define this particular schema. So there's systems and there's metasystems, and the one of the differences between them is a system. An example of a system is a Turing machine. An example of a metasystem is a universal Turing machine. The difference in a I don't know if you're aware of this, but the difference between a Turing machine and a universal Turing machine is that a universal Turing machine is a Turing machine that operates Turing machines, right? So it's a Turing machine that is functioning as an operating system for other Turing machines. So you can become very formal in this definition of the difference between a system and a metasystem. And it's interesting that in the literature, this distinction is not capitalized on, even though, you know, just, you know, universal Turing machines, there's not much literature about them and the relation with a system, because it's considered an unimportant thing. Okay. So, but once you get this picture of the difference between a whole that is greater than the sum of its parts and a whole that's the less than the sum of its parts, then there arises the question, what is a whole which is exactly equal to the sum of its parts? Is there such a thing as a whole that's exactly equal to the sum of its parts? And now what I do is I appeal to mathematics to try to figure out whether these distinctions mean anything or not. And it turns out that if you look at number theory, there are perfect numbers. And perfect numbers are numbers where the divisors exactly equal the number itself, right? The divisors of the number sum up to the number itself. Now, perfect numbers are very rare, right? We only know about 8 or 10 of them, and they have computers that are running continuously looking for the next one. And the fundamental basis of number theory is trying to figure out how to predict whether a number is a perfect number or not. But it turns out that there's not just perfect numbers. There's also, since classical antiquity, there's also amicable numbers. Now, an amicable number is a number where these divisors add up to this number, and these divisors over here add up to this other number. And so the parts of this add up to that whole, and the parts of that add up to that whole. And that's been known since antiquity. But in 1914, it was discovered that there's also sociable numbers. A sociable number is a number where these divisors add up to this number, these divisors add up to this number, these divisors, until it goes around in a circle. Right? So sociable numbers, okay, but each of these different kinds of numbers add up to their examples of parts that add up to the whole, exactly equal to the whole. Right? But after a delay, right? In other words, in the amicable number case, one number is adding up to the other one and so forth. There's a delay there. You know, there's a crossing of a boundaries between the numbers. And in a sociable number, the delay is around the circle. Most sociable numbers come in fours, but there's one that comes in 28. So the longest delay that's known is 28. And also, in number theory, people are looking for larger and larger sociable numbers now that they know they exist. There are other mathematical analogies that make exactly the same point. And basically what I did was looked at different kinds of mathematics and tried to find anomalous categories in mathematics. So for instance, there's non-orientable surfaces. And the famous one of that is the Mobius strip. You take a piece of paper and you twist it and you glue it back together. And it looks like it has two sides locally, but actually it only has one side. It looks like it has two boundaries locally, but it only has one. So those are non-orientable surfaces. And it turns out that there's a sequence in non-orientable surfaces, because you can take two Mobius strips and make a Kleinian bottle. And you can take two Kleinian bottles and make a hyperKleinian bottle. And in physics, there's another anomalous thing, which is the soliton. A soliton is a wave that's a hump of water. And they only exist in troughs, but they don't lose energy. So they can go on for, if they're not disturbed, they can go on essentially forever as long as the trough continues. And they don't lose any energy. They can pass through each other without losing energy. They can bounce off at the end of the trough and bounce back without losing any energy. It's a physical oddity. But it's an interesting physical oddity because almost every physical, major physical formula has soliton solutions. So even though it's an oddity, it proliferates throughout nature, this oddity. And it turns out that there's a hierarchy with solitons as well, because there's a thing called a breather. And a breather is basically a positive soliton and a negative soliton, right? A negative soliton is like a depression in the water rather than a hump. But if you put a positive and negative soliton together, they fall into each other, and they remain stable. So the difference between a soliton has to be moving down the trough, right? And you notice that Mobius strips are a lot like troughs, right? They have two sides, they go around. Breathers can remain stable in one place, right? And there's a lot of similarity between breathers and Kleinian bottles in some sense. And then there's these two classes here that are the super breather and the instantaneous. There's a kind of soliton which is called an instantaneous. And an instantaneous will pop from one place in space-time to another. And the way it does that is going through a potential trough rather than a physical medium. And So I hypothesize that there is the next level up, which I call a super breather, where two breathers exchange instantatons across across space-time. And then there's hyperkleinian bottles. And the hyperkleinian bottle, there's two forms of the Kleinian bottle. One form of the Kleinian bottle is this one that everyone knows, which kind of goes up like this and comes around through itself, right? But there's another kind of Kleinian bottle, which is inscribed on a circle. You basically take a figure eight-shaped tube and twist it 180 degrees and glue it back together. And so that's a Kleinian bottle, too. But if you took a cloverleaf-shaped tube and you twisted it 180 and put it back together, then you'd have two Kleinian bottles sharing the circle of their self-penetration. Because the thing about a Kleinian bottle is that it goes through itself. And so you can't tell whether it's open or closed, right? You can't tell whether it's inside or outside, right? These dualist distinctions are confused in the Kleinian bottle. So they're paradoxical. But the point is, of these mathematical analogies, is that in these anomalous effects in mathematics and physics, you get this same kind of differentiation that you get with the perfect, the amicable, and the sociable numbers. And basically what it's telling you is, where is the next emergent level? And with the mathematical analogies, it tells you a little bit about the characteristics of the next emergent level. And the interesting thing about it is that they're produced by conjunction. In other words, you take two Möbius strips and you put it together, you get a Kleinian bottle. You take two Kleinian bottles and put them together, you get a hyperkleinian bottle. Same with solitons. Two solitons, a negative and positive, put it together, you get a breather. Four, you put them together, you get the super breather. So in other words, the composition, the way of adding, you know, when we say the parts exactly equal the sum, you know, the whole exactly equals the sum of the parts, the way that the composition works is an odd way of working. But there are many examples in mathematics of this odd way of composition. Now, the thing is that these mathematical models get more complex, and the next more complex analogy is something called hypercomplex algebras. And basically, you know, we all learn real algebra when we're in school, and then some of us, when we get into college, we learn about complex numbers, right? Imaginary numbers. And that's this level. But we hardly ever learn about quaternions, octonions, and setonians, right? And what's interesting about this one was discovered in about 1850 by Hamilton, and in 1851 the octonions were discovered by Graves. I think that's the date. I'm not exactly sure. But the interesting thing about these algebras is that they're differentiated by losing properties. Okay, so when you go from the real to the complex, the conjugates are not identical in the complex numbers. And then if you go from the complex to the quaternions, you lose the commutative property, right? You can't just do the action backwards and get to the same place. When you do an action, you might have to do a whole bunch of actions to get back to where you were in the first place. That means behavior becomes important, right, at this level. Then what happens is, at the octonion level, is that you lose the associative property, right? That means the social becomes important, right? Who sits next to who at the dinner table becomes important at this level, right? And so if you associate things in one way, you'll get a totally different result than if you associate them in another way. And at the setonian level, it's the division property that you lose. And you get zero divisors. So you can't you know, the you can't just go back and forth between multiplication and division anymore. And basically, you get this fusion at that level because you can't divide things properly anymore. So the point of this is not, the point of this is that we're using the mathematics here to figure out what the nature of these emergent levels are and to get some information about the characteristics of the emergent levels. But you notice that at the octonion level, we lost the associative property, and so then the social becomes important. Okay, so that's the fundamental basis of my paper, that and why I'm, you know, interested in presenting it here, is because it gives you a way of grounding the theory of the social, because basically the you know, the autopoetic system, you know, Maturana and Varela came up with this idea of autopoetic system, which is kind of like an existential biology. It's not interested in the species, it's interested in the viability of the individual organism, how that homeostasis and is maintained over time. So autopoetic theory is this theory of the individual organism and its viability. There's been many attempts to take autopoietic theory and apply it to the social directly. But my position is that the social has to be an emergent level above the autopoietic with a different nature. So now the question becomes, how far up is that emergent level? What is the distance away of that emergent level from the lower level? And then what are its properties, right? So we can use mathematics, these anomalies in mathematics, to focus in on that. And the interesting thing about that is that when you start taking the different anomalies in mathematics that have the same structure and you put them together, they actually fit together. So you can think of, like in when I was looking at this other slide here, you can think of solitons traveling around Möbius strips. What happens when you do that? And then what happens when you take breathers and you put them, you theorize about what a breather is in the context of a Kleinian bottle. And so in my paper I try to explore some of those implications of the combination of these anomalous models. But I won't go into that here. I'm going to go on to another point, which is that I started out not studying systems theory. I started out studying ontology. And I came up with an idea based on Russell. Russell has something called the theory of logical types, and which is you have meta-levels, right? And so you have language, and then the meta-level up from language is grammar, because it's language about language, right? Or, and so then you can have, according to the theory of logical types, infinite meta-levels. And so what I did was I took the theory of logical types and tried to understand continental philosophy based on that, and tried to understand the different types of being that were found by the various continental philosophers in terms of this schema, and found that you could understand them. And basically what I've done, just to show you real quick, if you look at the, say, Heidegger, then the difference between present at hand and ready to hand, I call the difference between pure and process being. Pure being is being without time. Process being is being mixed with time, so it's the difference between Parmenides and Heraclitus. And then there's hyperbeing, which is Derrida calls difference. And then Merleau-Ponty in The Visible and the Invisible defines wild being. And so then I also Merleau-Ponty talks about the The difference between present hand and ready to hand is the difference between pointing and grasping. And then I think Lavanath, he talks about bearing, right? And I think that is the same thing for the kind of the psychological concomitant that's related to pointing and grasping. And then I think encompassing is the fourth one. But you can relate these to math, too. You know, you have determinant, then probabilities, then you have fuzzy sets and fuzzy logic with possibilities, and then you have propensities with chaos theory. So there's different kinds of math that have been developed that try to approach these different ways of that things can be in the world. So but this is the interesting point, which I'll finish on, which is that what I discovered was that the once you work out this typology, one thing to say is the interesting thing is not the meta levels of being. The interesting thing is that the fifth meta level is unthinkable, right? Bateson in Steps to Ecology of Mind, he talks about learning to learn. He starts going up that sequence, and he says he couldn't think the fifth meta level. And I tried, and I can't think the fifth meta level. I can't find anyone in the literature who has thought the fifth meta level. So I think that the fifth meta level is unthinkable. So there's only these four levels of being. And some kind of phase transition happens when you move up through wild being. But the interesting thing that I discovered was that if you say these are the five kinds of special systems, right, well, this is the meta system, this is the system, and these are the three intermediate systems, the four kinds of being are the differences between the two. And that, I think, is significant because these special systems are models of existence. And so what you have is you have an interleaving of being and existence. Being is basically projection. And the interesting thing is only in the Indo-European languages that there is such a thing as being. And one of the things that's happening with globalization is that this whole, you know, now 60% of the world's population speaks Indo-European languages, right, based languages. And so one of the things which is proliferating in this global mixture is this concept of being. And so it's, and most other languages have existence as the fundamental thing in their language. And so, but there's this interesting interleaving between being and existence. And then just, you know, to show you the theorists that I connect this to, you know, for the system, I connect that to Clear's work. For the dissipative ordering, I connect that to Prigogine's work. This autopoietic level, I connect to the work of Maturana and Varela. And then there are reflexive sociologists. When I was studying sociology, I was interested in the reflexive sociologists. So there's O'Malley and Sandywell. Sandywell is still working. But also, you know, one of the interesting things is you can connect this to what Deleuze and Guattari talk about in terms of they have desiring machines, they have this individual that they talk about in terms of being the body without organs, and they have the socius. And so within the Deleuze and Guattari schema, there's a nice kind of mix. And the reason I believe that mix is there is because Deleuze and Guattari are, they're some of the theorists who have been trying to build a philosophy at the wild being level. In fact, there I have the, you know, you can think of sociology as operating on these different levels. Most sociology never gets out of here, right? There's only a few sociologists who talk about philosophical and methodological issues, right, which is the kinds of things that you would talk at. You know, if you ask what is the essence of sociology, you're operating at this level. But then you can talk about hyper-sociology level, right, where that's where Derrida and Heidegger, with being crossed out, you know, starts getting used. But the wild being level, there's theorists who are actually trying to build philosophies at this level. Deleuze is one. John F. Hans is his name. H-A-N-S. John F. Hans. And Bataille. There's Plotnitsky, and other theorists. I guess I'll just put this up because it's here. Also, you can think about the levels of reflexivity as operating at this level, at these different meta levels. Basically, what happens is that reflexivity intensifies at each level. And so at the first level, just subjects look at each other as objects. So you get objectification, like in Peter Berger's idea of social construction. He talks about objectification of subjects. But at the next level, you get what Heidegger talks about. Heidegger talks about Dasein. He says thinking is the source of thinking, right? And he talks about sameness rather than identity. So you can think of Heidegger's work as basically elucidating this level here. And then the next level down I call the query, because there's this, at that level you're questioning the possibility of questioning, right? And so Dasein has this ecstasy where it's projecting being, but it doesn't really question its ability to question, right? You get that at the next level down. And then the last level down is I call the enigma, which is kind of like the way I expressed it here was the enigma is confronting itself as a sphinx, asking what is conscious, social, living humanity? And what you notice is that you know, if you look at these special systems, consciousness is a lot like a dissipative ordering system, right? And then we have the living organism and the social field. So those different emergent properties that we see in ourselves as the most significant have some affinity to these special systems. And the other thing that's interesting about the special systems is that they have ultra efficiency. In other words, I call it ultra efficaciousness. They're ultra efficient and ultra effective at the same time. And I think that that ultra efficiency and ultra effectiveness is the opposite of what Derrida calls difference, the differing and deferring of difference. But anyway, see what happens with the dissipative ordering is that it's negentropic. So there's this slight escape from entropy. Metasystems and systems are under entropy, but with these dissipative ordering systems, there's this marginal probabilistic escape from entropy, and that's what allows, you know, when it gets to living things to take over the whole ecosystem, you know, and I mean, we don't see living things out there in space and on other planets yet, but we see them in every single niche in the world, even in places where there's no sunlight. At the bottom of the ocean, there's life. And so the reason that can happen, the reason that life takes over like that is because it escapes entropy this ever so slightly, right, at the expense of, it's maintained generally, but locally there's this slight escape from entropy. And that gives tremendous leverage to these types of systems. And basically what happens is that the reflexive, the social level, is there too. It has this this kind of ramified, neganthropic ultra efficiency to it. So anyway, that's the basic story. So, you know, I hope it's useful. Thank you.